a conservation model which does not recognize that the most protected areas are those that were stewarded by the indigenous is a faulty model. So for us to say because there are gun-toting rangers, they were poaching before, is the wrong model to look at and to continue to perpetuate this very top-down colonial model of conservation.
Welcome to Animalia, a podcast all about making it easy and inclusive to learn about this big, beautiful planet, the life we share it with, and how to protect it. In 2017, I began my journey towards this very podcast and my passion for protecting this planet by helping out an incredible organization in Laos called the Lao Elephant Initiative. In fact, that team has been on this podcast. I would not be here today without that experience, without Michael and Sally, and most importantly, Mei Kam, the elephant who reached into my soul and turned on the light, so to speak, when it comes to my own priorities. While I learned a ton about wild elephants' role in forestation and our forest's role in sequestering carbon, I also had my eyes open to the true world of wildlife conservation, a world that is as complex and nuanced as it comes, a world where there are many differing viewpoints on the right conservation models, and where sometimes our battle over who's right and who's wrong delays conservation progress overall. It's with this in mind that I'm bringing you today's episode. A multi-year investigative study titled Stealth Game was published last year by the Oakland Institute with serious allegations against the Northern Rangelands Trust, one of the largest conservation NGOs on the ground in the world. The NRT, as you'll hear them referred to in this episode, is made up of 43 community conservancies covering over 60,000 square kilometers of land, roughly the size of the entire state of Kentucky. At face value, the NRT looks like an inspiring bunch, founded by the son of a man who once converted his cattle ranch into a rhino conservation, supported by mega pro-wildlife organizations such as the Nature Conservancy and the World Wildlife Fund, partnered with the Kenya Wildlife Services. However, Stealth Game paints a very different picture, one in which a top-down Western style of conservation is masked by a system of influence. The NRT does not own the lands, the communities do. However, the NRT is tightly involved in the larger system in which these communities govern themselves. According to the report, this has led to issues of forced displacement, violence, increased conflict, and questionable long-term conservation goals. Joining me today is the founder and director of Oakland Institute and author of this report, Anuradha Mittal. Now, it's important to know that the NRT has denied any and all of these allegations. And to their credit, they responded to my inquiry via email, and I will be including some of their responses in the discussion. The allegations Anuradha will be speaking to are just that, allegations. There is the possibility that some of those interviewed could have misspoken, have their own motives, or simply taken things out of context. I share this report and discussion with Anuradha not in hopes that you'll listen and instantly demonize or convict the NRT. They deserve the chance to put more counter-evidence out there before any conclusions are drawn. I share it more so that we don't just fall back on the traditional Western top-down influence conservation models, and instead push towards a world where we are giving indigenous communities full governance to steward the lands they have lived off for hundreds, in some cases, thousands of years. This is something the NRT seems to agree with in theory as well. They just have their own way of getting there that warrants a conversation. Okay, well, before we dig in, let's first meet Anuradha and learn more about her organization and the work that went into this report.
My name is Anuradha Mittal. I'm executive director of the Oakland Institute. Oakland Institute is an independent policy think tank based in Oakland, California. We work on issues at the nexus of human rights, agriculture, development. We look at policies that promote development paradigms to determine if they actually benefit the communities they're supposed to. While we look at policies that come out of institutions such as the World Bank, we often look at specific cases at the request of communities. So if you visit our website at oaklandinstitute.org, you will see our work in places ranging from Sri Lanka to Papua New Guinea to Nicaragua, Ethiopia, Sierra Leone to Kenya and Tanzania. In November last year, we published a report called Stealth Game, and it looks at the impact of so-called community conservancies on the pastoralist communities. This work we embarked on because we were asked to look at the impact of Lapsset Corridor, this development scheme, which would create a web of airports, oil pipelines, freeways, resort towns. The lands on which they would be built, what benefit they would bring to the communities on whose lands they were being built, and how they would impact them if negatively. As I embarked on field research along with the other field researchers, it was incredible to arrive in Isiolo in northern Kenya. And any community I visited, whether these were the Maasai communities or Samburu or Burana, instead of wanting to talk about Lapsset Corridor, instead of talking about the oil pipeline or the impact of this large crocodile dam, people wanted to talk about Northern Rangelands Trust. This is one of the largest conservancies program in Kenya, which owns 43 so-called community conservancies. But the communities wanted to elevate their struggles against this model of conservation, which was neo-colonial, militarized, privatized, which was not just bringing conservation dollars to these agencies and impoverishing the communities, but they had very serious allegations of human rights abuses. So that's the genesis of our report, Stealth Game, and that's the nature of our work at the Oakland Institute.
Got it. Just a couple of questions about the Oakland Institute. I believe it's a nonprofit, correct?
Yes, it's a nonprofit.
And I imagine these studies, and especially these, all these places all over the world, are not inexpensive to do and do thoroughly, as your team does. Where does a lot of the sort of budget come from? Is it more grassroots, small donation? Do you have a couple of big donors? Is it, you know, does government contribute to it? Like, where grants, things like that, academia, where does kind of the budget for these things come from? And what does it take to conduct a study like this? Like, what is the overall time and cost of a study like this?
Well, that's an excellent question. First of all, if you look at our annual reports, our budget is less than, you know, $600,000. So for a nonprofit which puts out this very thorough research, it's a very minuscule budget. And that is because we are small and agile and we work with researchers on the ground. In terms of who finances our work, I said it's an independent think tank. We do not accept any corporate or any government funding. We do not take any aid, say, from USAID or any of the aid agencies of any government in Europe. Our resources come from individual donors. They come from some family foundations, like most of the 501c3 organizations in the United States. Needless to say, given our rigorous research where we do not, we are not afraid to take on powerful actors. These are progressive family foundations. We also receive honorarium when we do speaking engagements, say at the universities.
Got it. And for a project like Stealth Game, how long did it take to conduct that study from beginning to end?
Well, when you look at Stealth Game, the allegations against Northern Rangelands Trust are pretty egregious. So at the Institute, we are known for our rigorous research, for meticulous research. You might not like what we say, but you can't poke a hole through it. So that kind of work took over 2.5 years of very in-depth field research, desk research, continued communication, verifying facts, checking in with different resources. We do not rely on just one individual giving us a certain story, verifying facts for ourselves, connecting with local NGOs, connecting with national NGOs, reaching out with the findings where the party is concerned, with the different stakeholders, government agencies. So this report in itself took over 2.5 years.
Wow. And how many people worked on it total?
Well, I would say a team of, anywhere from 15 to 20 people. A lot of the people are based in Kenya, are the researchers that we brought on. They are not named in the report for security purposes, which we often do for different countries where we work in.
As I said up in the beginning, I have reached out to the NRT about Stealth Game, and they have categorically denied any and all the allegations made in the report. They also attempted to discredit the Oakland Institute and challenge the depth of reporting done here by Anurata and her team, citing that they believe the Oakland Institute simply handpicked a few reports that were written over the course of a couple years and have no knowledge that anyone from Oakland Institute was on the ground during this time. Now, the trouble I have with that claim from the NRT on discrediting this report overall is the reputation generally of the Oakland Institute and the depth and quality of the reporting is quite strong. They have a passing grade from a couple of different auditors of NGOs. And the specificity and quantity of the examples provided point to either, well, true on-the-ground reporting or pure storytelling the likes of George R. R. Martin would even be impressed by. To this point, on their site, the Oakland Institute shares a number of different signed petitions from NRT community members. And I'll link to them, and I encourage you to check them out on your own. Now, a petition alone is by no means proof of wrongdoing. No matter what approach you take to anything, someone will always think they know a better way. But it does point to some level of discontent here. Then there's the question of motivation. The Oakland Institute is a nonprofit that is not heavily funded by global NGO standards and points the funding towards the team doing this field research. They are not paid for the outcome of their reporting from any indicator I can see, and I can't find any prior link to anyone from Oakland and the NRT that would hint at some personal vendetta. So I think we can and should take the integrity of Oakland's work here seriously. Now, that also doesn't mean all the allegations are indeed true. I would encourage you to read the Stealth Game report for yourself, which is linked in the show notes. The reason this discussion is important is because we need to let go of our Western colonial top-down model of conservation, where we protect remaining wild lands by more or less policing them, instead of providing resources and funding for local communities to do it without needing, necessarily, to partner with us. Whether or not programs like the NRT are necessary steps along the way of getting there is really the debate here. Too often, even if these programs have the right initial intentions, which I think we can take the NRT's word for it, they do, they are slippery slopes to their own forms of corruption and abuse, given the power dynamics they present. There's absolutely the chance that there may be some context missing in some of the reporting in Stealth Game, or that a local community member simply misconstrued details of a particular incident. However, that does not mean we should not carefully examine and question if these Western conservation models are the right ones, even if they are facilitated with good intentions. All right, now let's better understand the Northern Rangelands Trust and the background of this organization.
Well, NRT was created by Ian Craig, whose family was part of the minority white elites in Kenya. It was set up when the family-owned ranch was not doing well and it was turned into a rhino sanctuary. Since then, NRT has grown. Today, it has over 43 so-called community conservancies. It controls nearly 8% of the country's land. We're talking about over 42,000 square kilometers of land, which is over 10,378,000 acres of land in northern and coastal Kenya. The communities that live in the lands on these lands are predominantly pastoralists. They raise livestock for their livelihoods, and they have faced, you know, decades and decades of marginalization by successive Kenyan governments. NRT has established itself claiming that its goal is to transform people's lives, to secure peace, to conserve natural resources. If you actually visit the communities that are impacted by its activities, they allege that NRT has dispossessed them of their lands, their livelihoods. It has deployed armed security units that have been responsible for serious human rights abuses, that NRT takes sides in ethnic conflicts. As it takes over lands, the pasture lands for communities have shrunk in size, which has led to inter-ethnic conflicts, and then NRT sides with one side against the other. So there's a long litany of allegations against NRT. The communities have written, as I said before, to the different donors. It is pretty shocking that when these kind of allegations have been made, that the donors have not really carried out an independent assessment. Last year, Danida carried out an assessment of NRT. They did not talk to the main communities that were impacted that had petitioned them. So this has basically led to not just the donors, but NRT being able to carry out its work against the wishes of the communities that it claims to be helping with absolute impunity.
And is ecotourism the primary revenue stream of NRT or no?
Well, NRT is engaged in many activities. On one hand, it has this millions of conservation dollars that are being funneled into the organization from different aid agencies and Western conservation groups. At the same time, it manages, safaris. It manages also, the trading of the beef. It manages a lot of the beadworks and other things. So it has far more power at times, it feels, than the Kenyan government itself. It is, works very closely with state agencies, such as the Kenyan Wildlife Services, who often have the same donors, they carry out the same operations. But more important, people from NRT sit on the board of Kenya Wildlife Services, and people from Kenya Wildlife Services sit on the board of NRT. So it's basically a very close connection between the government agencies and NRT and its donors. So it has like this incredible amount of power compared to the marginalized pastoralists who have not been heard once since they have been complaining for decades now.
So what exactly is this Western conservation model I've been referring to versus the community conservation model that NRT says they stand for? Well, let's have Anuradha break that down.
Well, let's first start with the word conservation. You know, living in the West, living in the United States, when I think of conservation, for instance, I think of, say, Yellowstone Park. You think of the Western model of conservation where you think human beings are apart from nature. You create these vast, pristine landscapes with boundaries and fences with guards with guns. That has been the model of conservation, to protect pristine areas. That conservation model is followed around the world as we create these national parks, protected spaces. Now, this model also forgets that 80% of the biodiversity is protected in areas which are stewarded by the indigenous. The indigenous worldview is that human beings are not separate from nature, but they are an important part of the ecology. They're part of the territories. There's a relationship. And that model has continued also, as you said, around the world. And that is under threat. When you hear the two terms put together, community conservancies, one assumes that this is conservation, where the local communities are closely involved in the protection, protection and in preserving the ecology, the biodiversity of the place. So that is what community conservancies mean. What you have to really look at is that, is it really a community conservancy, which means that it has the free, prior, informed consent of the community? Or a conservancy has been created which uses, you know, terms like participatory, empowerment, community conservation, but communities actually do not have a say in it. And this is what we're talking about when we look at the case of Northern Rangelands Trust in Kenya. A lot of this, you know, language is used, euphemisms are used, but you see lands being taken away from communities against their will through corruption, through co-optation, and worse still, through intimidation, violence, and human rights abuses. And this is why communities, whether it is Sambaru or, you know, the Buranas, or whether the Pokot communities, they're rising up and challenging this model of conservation, which is practiced it has a veneer of community conservancy, but it is nothing else but fortress conservation.
We're gonna get to the allegations of violence and human rights abuses in terms of examining the details in Stealth Game and responses from the NRT. I certainly don't want it to seem like we're skipping over that. I think it's first helpful to set up the foundation of the problem here. The underlying distinction between a community conservancy and what Anuradha calls fortress conservation is very much the basis of the allegations made in the report against the NRT. Now, the NRT in responses to me adamantly dispute the label of a fortress conservation and stand by their position as a community conservancy. The NRT describes all governing boards of each conservancy member as one that is democratically elected, with a new board elected every 3 years. From the NRT's point of view, they have sort of a step model or a graduation model, as they cited in the response to me, for communities to build towards more and more financial independence. The NRT does not technically own the conservancy lands, something they have also reiterated to me, and this is true. However, they offer a lot of economic and strategic resources for those who become members, which a community has to apply to do. Wider access to trade for commodities such as sheep or cattle and security resources are two examples of the carrots more or less dangled in front of these communities for joining. Once joined, that community land is still legally theirs, and they have the right to file a motion to leave the NRT anytime. But if the benefits of joining are primarily benefiting those in power in that community council at the expense of the wider group, well, one can see a scenario where the council remains in the NRT, even if it's not in the best interest of the greater community. Let's say we take NRT's word for it, that their system of partnership between the community and NRT has all the right intentions. The perspective from Anurata is that these local communities know what they are doing. They have lived in unison with their local ecosystems for thousands of years. If anything, we should be learning from them, not the other way around. Yes, local conflict and corruption can get in the way. But oftentimes, historically speaking, those events have a direct line of influence to Western powers. And in more recent years, China's increasing influence in Africa economies as well. The NRT may truly believe that in order to get a local community conservancy to the point where it can sustain itself while hitting its environmental and social goals, well, it needs partnerships to get there, not just a passive grant of resources. I'm personally not in a position to necessarily dispute that. I don't have enough local knowledge or experience. What I do know is that there are many, many examples where some of the best conservation success around the planet is happening in regions where local indigenous communities have full and complete control of their lands. No partnerships required. An example of this came from a UN report in 2021, looking at forest health in the Amazon. Between the areas where indigenous communities had full unbridled control versus those where they were partnered in some way with government or private funding. Well, the indigenous controlled areas sequester 20% more carbon on average and a 25% less deforestation on average. Is NRT a fortress conservation, as Stealth Game points out, or is it a community conservation, or at least creating a long-term pathway for true community conservancy, as the NRT lays claims to? Our listeners will have to decide for themselves. There is little doubt, however, that the NRT plays a big role in setting up the structure for how these communities are governed. The NRT has made their position clear that their program, working in partnership with the local communities, is the best path forward for conservation success. Anurata sees this very differently.
Well, to NRT and to the donors who would say that I think we very well know that the time for the colonial white man's burden to be the messiah to protect Africa is over. So it's pretty stunning to hear that if we were not here, the indigenous who have stewarded the lands would suddenly destroy it all, that they're corrupt because they're Black Africans and they can be corrupted when we know, when you look at the environmental collapse that we see around us, is the Western consumerism. So this very top-down colonial racist mindset, which is allowed to still perpetuate, that if they were not there, there would be a complete collapse of conservation, there would be complete collapse of biodiversity, is quite stunning in today's day and world. And that's why it has to really tackle and dismantle this white supremacy behind conservation, which assumes that the white man who has destroyed the environment has the answers and solutions to protect the environment by dispossessing yet once again the native Africans. A conservation model which does not recognize that the most protected areas are those that were stewarded by the indigenous is a faulty model. So for us to say because they are gun-toting rangers, they were poaching before, is the wrong model to look at and to continue to perpetuate this very top-down colonial model of conservation. And it is not just that the Oakland Institute said it. When you look at the reports from the UN rapporteurs on indigenous affairs, UN rapporteur on the environment, they all recognize that we need a different way to look at conservation. So to determine if NRT has been successful just by looking at, well, have they managed to preserve wildlife, is a faulty way of looking at it, because that system is broken and you can't just fix that broken system. You have to replace it with a system that we do know works, which is genuine participation by communities, community-owned and managed conservancies.
To be clear, there have been some conservation successes under the NRT. Illegal elephant poaching is down the last few years, and the NRT has helped return Rothschild giraffes to Lake Baringo after a 7-year absence. And there are other success stories elsewhere too. The Stealth Game report is not necessarily challenging that the NRT has had some conservation success. The question is, at what cost? At what social cost? To what end? And how sustainable is it long-term if the more successful communities have a dependency on a very well-funded NGO to get there? For example, being too aggressive on protecting land can actually disrupt some established ways of life, such as pastoralism, which, while they may help boost some wildlife numbers in the short term, could lead to more complications long-term if more people need to find work, and in the cases of, let's say, industrialized agriculture or poaching, that work is not very environmentally friendly.
Right now, 80% of the biodiversity is protected by the indigenous. Despite the checks being thrown around, it has not been destroyed by them. So I think it is very important to remember, because we can get caught in it. Enough money comes. Secondly, we have to look at, and what you touched upon, opportunities. You know, as the spaces are shrinking, as opportunities are leaving, people being forced when it comes to feeding their families, they might be driven into poaching. But most of the time we're talking about, say, pastoralists, semi-pastoralists, who depend on pastoralism for their livelihoods. When you're creating in the name of conservation these pristine land areas and denying people their livelihoods, they might be forced into taking up ways of making money which are harmful for the environment. So I think even before we get there, the whole idea of destroying livelihoods and then forcing people perhaps into means of employment which are not conducive to the environment is really problematic. The other thing is, we have to be very careful. A lot of community members who have disappeared, who have been killed, I'm not just talking about NRT or Kenya, I'm talking about around the world. For instance, World Wildlife situation in the DRC, the women who were beaten and raped, they were fishing. They were fishing in the ancestral rivers where they've always fished to capture fish, which is the main source of protein. So in the name of conservation, when we are taking away not just means of livelihood, but means of food security, and this is where the indigenous worldview is very important. Human beings have lived in harmony with nature. The whole idea of creating a national park like Yosemite or your Yellowstone Park with these boundaries where nobody lives, that's not how the world has been. And even today, majority of the world is not like that. People live in a symbiotic relationship with the land. They protect the land, they protect the trees because they depend on it. They have spiritual relationships with their forests, with the tree gods. They seek their medicinal herbs from those regions. So I think we have to challenge a very Western-dominated neocolonial mindset, which thinks of conservation as these protected areas which have to be protected from human beings. Perhaps they have to be protected from who we have become in Western societies. But to assume everyone who lives in those areas is poachers is very detrimental, and it is the wrong step to move forward on this debate.
Yeah, and it's a really good point. And it's sort of, it's a very kind of, you know, frankly, white Anglo-Saxon view of environmentalism, environmental protection, about leaving the land alone and no one touches it, right? And it's sort of, well, yeah, like, you know, for those of us that live in suburbia and have it so easy in terms of just running down the street and going to a store and having an abundance of food choices in front of us, it's easy for those types of people, myself and included in that mix, to think of land protection as being untouched, right? Like that's how we protect land. But that's not how we protect land. It's how we protect maybe, you know, like you said, like a certain national park, in a sense of like in a Western way, like a Yellowstone. But that's just because, you know, and I actually think even in the US, there's starting to be a movement that I really stand behind of giving control of even our parks back to indigenous communities. Like, why do we have Native Americans, indigenous people? I don't even like calling them Native Americans because they didn't pick that name for themselves. Why do we have indigenous communities living on reservations instead of living in Glacier National Park, in Yellowstone? They would be the best stewards of those parks. Those parks would thrive, right? And why not give the control back to them? If we really want to protect them long term, it's probably the best way to do it. Mm-hmm. And it allows them to, you know, so sort of, you know, return to their cultural roots. I mean, their cultural roots is like, I've been to Navajo Nation and it's just Denny's and McDonald's and Arby's and just, you know, I believe, you know, our indigenous people in the U.S. have the highest rate of type 2 diabetes yeah. for these reasons too. They did not choose to dine at Arby's and Denny's. That is not their culture. That is our culture. That's a white American. Denny's is not an indigenous company. Yeah. And so I think it's a good point, and it's even more important, I think, in parts of the world where, it's not even more important. It's important everywhere. Right. I mean, I think it's important everywhere, frankly. It's important in Kenya and it's important here too. And I hope that does end up transpiring here, because it's the best way to protect those lands ultimately is giving them back to control the people that live in harmony with them. Because they also, indigenous people actually strengthen the land. They strengthen the land's resiliency. Certain, you know, types of regenerative, you know, biodynamic agriculture is good for ecosystems. And so, you know, that is a step forward that I hope we can make. It's something we've talked about here, like on my newsletter a lot, in Brazil as well, in the Amazon. Like, why aren't we just giving the Amazon back to indigenous communities? And by the way, if you want to, you know, instead of forcing them into, you know, raising cattle or palm oil to monetize those lands, we know a healthy forest, its role in sequestering carbon. And we know added carbon, how it affects changing weather and extreme weather and the damages it causes. There is a model that exists that would pay indigenous people to just live, mm-hmm. right? And just say, hey, if you're living and you're protecting this lands, there's economic monetary value of that through the carbon sequestration. I mean, look at the carbon markets. Look at how much companies are paying for offsets and paying to, you know, to move carbon credits around. That math applies to indigenous communities. There's no reason that, in my mind, we couldn't pay indigenous communities to do it, to live as they're meant to live. Because we know that there's monetary value for all of us by protecting these forests, protecting these natural ecosystems and the carbon sinks they serve.
I think, James, what you said is very relevant. I mean, when we look at Yellowstone Park and you talk about conservation, what made the bisons disappear? You and I both know. What happened to the bisons?
It was the settlers.
It was the settlers.
Yeah.
The killings that happened. So, and as you said, to put communities on these reservations. So we have a long practice of doing that. And now we want to do it around the world. The other thing we have to also look at in the name of conservation, when we look at the pollution, you talked about regenerative agriculture, you call it agroecological agriculture, the practices that the indigenous have always practiced, that's seen as backward. Whereas the impact of, say, industrial agriculture based on fossil fuels, the destruction it has caused to biodiversity, while we talk about conservation. When we talk about the Amazon, again, you know, it is not the palm oil companies or the logging, that's not done by the indigenous. You have to follow the money. Who benefits when the indigenous lose? So whether it was in the United States, the settlers won economically, politically, as the indigenous were forced onto the reservations. Or you look at the Amazon, or you look at the different ethnic groups that are suffering from the oppression of NRT. It is a continuation of the same colonial, bigotry against, you know, the indigenous, against the locals. And it is racist, which thinks that it is superior to the indigenous knowledge, that it is modern compared to what's backward. And the crisis that we live in today, the climate crisis, everyone knows that's not because of the consumption patterns of the Boranas or the Samberus or the Maasai or those, the tribes in Amazon. So this continuation of false solutions, which is then well-oiled and financed by donor countries and Western agencies, and to not do an investigation and listen to the communities is horrific. And this is why our report Stealth Game, again, coming back to NRT, calls for holding not just NRT accountable, but the donors accountable, who for so long have turned a blind eye and ignored the petitions and the complaints of the local communities against this top-down conservation model.
From what I can tell, there are two main areas the NRT heavily influences for its member conservancies that are sort of at the crux of this debate as to the ethics of what they're doing: economics and security. Let's talk economics first. Many of these local communities are pastoralists, a very traditional form of domesticated animal husbandry, rearing livestock in a rather nomadic lifestyle, roaming through pastures and wild lands, making trades along the way. The NRT has introduced a couple key levers into the system. The first is expanding trade. NRT has expanded trade partners for the region, which in many cases is a good thing. These are traditionally very poor communities that need economic support. However, that can come in the form of transitioning pastoralism to ranching, with an eye towards the more industrialized livestock farming we practice here in the U.S. today, which we are learning week by week is really damaging to the environment. This is very analogous to our own displacement of indigenous communities here in the United States, especially in our colonization of the West in the 19th century. Many indigenous tribes were nomadic herders and hunters of buffalo. U.S. colonists saw an opportunity for a more efficient use of that land in the form of cattle ranching, which then cleared more space for towns and infrastructure needed to scale it. Over time, they essentially wiped out the more nomadic, sustainable practices of indigenous tribes in exchange for their own more economic, prosperous ones. The rest, of course, is history. The other leg of NRT's economic influence comes in the form of ecotourism, something the NRT has introduced at a very high rate, and something it sees as a critical pillar for sustainable financial independence for local communities. Again, ecotourism is not bad in any absolute form. In some cases, it can be very good. However, it can also be abused in the forms of things like forced captive breeding to boost safari numbers or locals being moved and displaced in order to expand tourism ranges. Whether or not the NRT has crossed that sustainable threshold for its push with ecotourism, I cannot say definitively. Nor can the Oakland Institute, as that would probably require years and years of on-the-ground field research to verify. However, there are valid reasons to raise doubts and ask questions based on some of the allegations reported to by Oakland in their study, as well as the size and growth of the ecotourism revenues in NRT's own financial reporting. Influencing communities via economics versus over-control is a very effective way to do so, because it often results in a small handful of influential locals gaining direct benefits and voting to protect the system, granting them that better lifestyle, even if it's not for the greater good of its people. Again, whether or not that is actually happening here in the NRT, and if so, which community specifically it's happening to, still needs more investigation. But it's easy to see how this dynamic can play out.
Well, first of all, it is not surprising that certain community members can be co-opted. You know, it is not specific to the regions where NRT is operating. It's a global phenomenon. You know, the rulers have always divided to rule. So that's not common. We also have to understand that the areas we're talking about are arid, semi-arid regions. In times of drought, for instance, the lack of pasture land for pastoralists make people go out to further areas. Now, as these community conservancies have been created, the space that is available to the pastoralists for their livelihoods, for their cattle, is shrinking. So of course it spills over into ethnic clashes. Cattle raiding is not new, for instance, but as that space is shrinking, there's more ethnic conflict. Yes, there are cattle raids, but the problem is that NRT is directly involved. For instance, when it takes sides, for instance, in the interviews that were conducted by the Oakland Institute, multiple sources within the community, including members of the councils of community elders, they informed us that as many as 76 people were killed in Biliko Bulesa Conservancy during inter-ethnic clashes, and that NRT was clearly siding with one community, helping with, providing resources, sending in guards, at the same time helping remove people who were injured. There are traditional ways of handling conflicts, whether you are in Ethiopia, whether you're in Sudan or in Kenya or in Tanzania. These traditional systems have always been there, which have helped these different ethnic groups resolve their conflicts. But with the presence of NRT, the communities allege that those traditional systems are failing, resulting in more violence and more deaths and more loss of animals.
You know, I think the point you made is really just true historically across every step of human existence of divide and conquer, right? It is much easier to rule, and especially in any kind of authoritarian way, a divided group of people, because, you know, they sort of spend more time fighting each other than looking up at the problem that they're both facing. Right. And we saw that happen here in this country. I mean, I think that was kind of the playbook of Donald Trump, frankly, right? It was create a lot of divisiveness, create a lot of tension. You know, we saw how that played out, and we saw it still playing out here in the country. Mm-hmm. We're, I think, more divided than we've been probably since our Civil War. Yeah, it makes sense that, like, I mean, unfortunately, that playbook has been around for centuries, thousands of years of divide and conquer.
I'm glad you said that, because it's not just that, again, it is ignorant, illiterate Africans who succumb to it. As you said, it's right here in the United States. It is, you know, the strategy which has been used forever, that you co-opt a few, you divide to be able to, say that these are all lies. You make it a he said, she said story. And so people can forget the facts. And this is why at the Institute, we carried out this investigation to put forward issues that were raised by the communities to demand an independent investigation. You mentioned that there have been few responses from NRT. You know, for me, it is pretty stunning that if NRT has nothing to hide, if all these community members are lying, the allegations of killings are wrong, that people who have talked about their loved ones being killed by rangers, that it's all a myth and it is a lie, I would think that NRT would welcome an independent investigation to clear its name. I mean, the hoo-ha, and then, you know, we did a webinar and the number of its employees who joined to try to kind of, create a disarray is pretty stunning. If you have nothing to hide, why are you complaining? You would welcome an independent investigation. You would open up your books. You would let the communities speak. You would resolve the issues.
Well,
but
I'm sure
for that
what they're...
not to happen is makes you wonder why.
Yeah, I mean, the challenge there is how someone terms the word independent, because I imagine if what they could be doing is they're working to try to find someone who looks independent that they can kind of co-opt, right, to do a study. We see that all the time. I mean, look at sort of the fossil fuel companies with climate reports for the last 50 years, right? There's a lot of independent studies that show that they don't have any, like, they're not contributing to global warming. Right. But you know, just because it's done by a third party does not make it independent.
That's a very important point that you just made, James. And I think the report, Stealth Game, what it says is, unfortunately, not new. This is not the first study. There have been endless number of academic papers as well as fact-finding missions by the local communities, which clearly point to serious grievances of the communities against NRT community conservancies. Now, despite that, the funders, the donors, have chosen to look the other way. And of course, they would want to clear their name than do right. But I think at this time, as more and more reports are coming out, we weren't even aware that when we came out with a report, another think tank in Germany came out with its own report. I know there are many other reports that are in the works. So it is basically a situation of, you know, Dracula being dragged into the sunlight. It has no place to hide. It has no place to run. Mm-hmm. The point you make about independent is very important. Following our report, the donors have announced that there will be an independent investigation. So far, none of the communities that have gone to court around NRT community conservancies, who have been organizing protests, who have done petitions, the Council of Elders or the local organizations, none of them have been contacted. So I think we are closely watching to monitor what this so-called independent investigation looks like and if it is really independent and who they will be speaking to.
A great example of showcasing where this type of economic influence the NRT has can be problematic is in the 2015 agreement between the British Tullow Oil Company and local conservancy communities in the NRT to extract black gold from their lands. And this was done at a time when we are desperately trying to get off fossil fuels. The Stealth Game report cites that this is an agreement between the NRT and the oil company directly. And the NRT corrected this in their response that They're not direct parties of the agreement, but that response points to the challenges at play here. Specifically, the NRT cited, the true position is that the communities in Turkana and West Pokot had incorporated community conservancies in 2010. These communities approached the NRT seeking support. NRT brokered financial support for these community conservancies from the two oil companies who had licenses to operate in those districts. So in their own words, they brokered the deal between the communities and the oil company, which again is a clever way of making sure this happens without putting your name on the dotted line. If economics are one key area of influence, the other is security. The NRT has formed a security unit called Nine Teams, made up mostly from local community members, but who operate under the direction and training of the NRT. They then provide the communities with these security teams as part of being an NRT member, with the promise to protect them from local conflict and crack down on poaching. The Nine Teams are given the right to act with lethal force if deemed necessary. Now, while the intentions of protection and anti-poaching may be prudent, the effects are a sort of pseudo-police state where local communities have independence on paper, but their day-to-day security is coming from a more centralized command. As a result, there are many allegations in Stealth Game of violence and human rights violations. The NRD categorically denies all of these allegations.
A lot of the work that NRT does is through alleged, intimidation and violence. Our report Stealth Game brings forward several testimonies of family members who have lost loved ones, and they allege it was NRT rangers who killed them. There are allegations from the community in Buleka Bulesa who talk about how many members of the community were killed in a raid where NRT sided with the other party. So when you have those kind of allegations, when you have gun-toting, rangers, the fear that is put in the hearts of people over and over again during field research, we heard, we have fear in our hearts. We cannot go where we used to go. These are ancestral lands. And this is happening while Kenyan Constitution of 2010, the 2016 Community Land Act, recognizes community land. So here you have NRT in a rush to declare conservancies instead of communities being able to register their lands as communal lands.
One such allegation is the 2019 murder of Ahmed Abdi Rahman, who was allegedly killed at a water point involving six NRT employees in uniform. Now, the NRT sees this incident differently. Again, I'm quoting their response. The tragic death of Mr. Rahman was an ethnic killing of a member of the Borana community by Samburu Moran at the Koro Hot Spring. There was no involvement by NRT rangers in the incident at all, let alone a shooting involving six NRT employees in uniform. The NRT pointed out to me that none of these allegations have led to convictions of any of the nine unit members, in their mind proving these are all false. While that may be true, that there have been no convictions, however, given the NRT's extremely tight relationship with the Kenyan government, well, there's no easy way to parse what type of influence they may or may not have had in such cases when they come up. Let's take another example, the eviction of the Ogiek community.
In the case of the Ogiek communities, this is a community that has even gone to the African Commission, African Court for Human Rights, and actually won a victory where the Kenyan government was clearly told by the African Court to respect the indigenous rights. Now, come 2020, we saw again how the indigenous were being evicted from their own lands that they have lived and forever, what they call the ancestral lands. And I think this is the point that I was trying to make when we started a conversation, that it's not just specific to NRT or even to Kenya, whether you see Tanzania or whether you see Congo or whether you see countries in Asia. This whole idea and the push that comes from Western conservation organizations, from the Western aid agencies, that we have to control our environment. We have to create these national parks, that the indigenous who have been the stewards of the land, instead of respecting and lauding them and thanking them for protecting the biodiversity, they have to be evicted. Very much the same thing that we have done here in the United States, that we have done in the Western world. It is the same model that continues to push. And despite having this major victory in the African Court, you find the communities still struggling to be able to live on their ancestral lands. So the situation we describe in the stealth game in Northern and Kenya is not just specific to Northern Kenya. This is, you know, when you see places like Kenya and Tanzania, which are, you know, so rich with wildlife, with biodiversity, unfortunately have become a punishment for the indigenous who have protected those lands forever.
In 2016, Kenya passed a Community Land Act, which recognized pastoralism as a legitimate system and one that should come with land control. The goal of this legislature was indeed to return ownership rights across much of Kenya back into the hands of local community stewards. However, in the years since, very few communities have been successfully rewarded their rights back to them. Short staffing in the office designed to carry out this provision is one of the reasons why. An estimated 3.5 million people are still waiting on their registration approval. That accounts for 67% of Kenya's landmass. 2016 Kenya Community Land Act. I read it following its mentioned in Stealth Game. It seems to just contradict the NRT as an entity in terms of how it's written on paper. Yeah. Of course, implementation is different. Is that fair to say that those things kind of contradict each other, the Community Land Act and the NRT? And if so, is it just pure economics and money that have sort of risen NRT above that legislature? Or is that legislature just a name only and you know, it's not taken seriously by the Kenyan government?
Well, you mentioned the 2016 Community Land Holding and, Land Act. It's very important because it actually recognized community land as a category of land holding and pastoralism as a legitimate livelihood system. And the act was kind of unprecedented move, which enables communities to register their land as communal land. You know, in the West, we know of private property, the land title being in my name, my house title in my name. But this really allows communities to legally register, own, as well as manage their communal lands. Unfortunately, as you said, you know, implementation is another thing. For the first 3 years, nothing had really happened. And it was really in July 2019 that some communities tried to register the lands. Now, in light of that, when we reported, our report came out, you might have seen, we say 39 conservancies that are run by NRT. Since then, they have started talking about 43. So they are in an effort to beat the community's effort to actually register their lands as communal lands. This is what the communities are asking for, that before you establish so-called community conservancies, let the land be registered as communal land, which is jointly owned and managed by the communities, rather than NRT able to come in and register it as a community conservancies with like 5 to 10 signatures. And the whole thing behind it is, let's call it what it is, corruption. And that is where the strings that NRT can pull with, powerful in the country, you know, the political and economic elites in the country, its connections with the Western donors becomes really problematic.
If anything, current dealings in Kenya are moving further away from upholding the Community Land Act and heading more towards conservancy models such as the NRT. A new conservancy bill was put into place in 2021 that further paves the way for well-funded conservancies to claim rights to land in the name of these sort of top-down conservation models. This may make it even harder yet for local communities to have true, unencumbered land stewardship. I asked Enerata what she believes the Kenyan government can and should do to better uphold the ideals behind that 2016 Land Act.
Well, you know, Kenyan government as an independent country should be a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. The fact that in the name of conservation, you're so influenced by outside donors that you turn against your own citizens, these pastoralists, these indigenous communities are also the citizens of Kenya, to ensure that, you know, action had been taken. There have been reports made to the police. No investigations were done. Nothing was done. There are similar reports of abuses by the Kenyan wildlife services, of evictions of indigenous communities from areas which they want to call conservation, to declare local communities as poachers. It would require, first of all, investigation, but at the same time, real empowerment of communities and recognition of the basic human rights. We talked about the Land Act, implementation of that Land Act. where on one hand, the government recognizes something called communal land that the communities depend on, especially pastoralist communities depend on communal land. They should be moving as fast as they can to actually have those lands titled as communal lands rather than allow Ian Craigs of the world to come in and declare what are community conservancies. So there are many actions that can be taken for a government to really operate freely. Having said that, I would also say it is very hard to be an African government where you have donor countries, donor agencies breathing down your neck to follow the Western prescriptions even today.
If the allegations made in Stealth Game are indeed mostly false or misconstrued, then what do we make then of the many petitions shared from Oakland Institute from communities within the NRT that wish to leave and break free? The NRT cites that there are always going to be disputes in any system. And yes, there is merit there. But time and time again, they seem to pin the reason behind these petitions as local disputes within communities that have nothing to do with the NRT per se, but wanting to blame or leave the NRT because of their relationship with the local governing body in dispute. How much of this is due to the systems NRT is introducing versus just true local disputes? It's really hard to discern. Maybe a lot, maybe very little. Probably a mixed bag. On March 10th, the NRT wrote me directly via email that as of the end of February, no conservancy has ever left the NRT. A testament to how strong their system is. Although one could also read that as just the opposite, a testament to how difficult it is to break free even if warranted. Well, as it turns out, on March 9th of this year, one day before I got that email, leaders of the Neminyak Conservancy, I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that, formally filed for withdrawal from the NRT. When I asked the NRT for comment, they sent me their own letter, dated 2 days later, March 11th, that the NRT's Council of Elders had decided to indefinitely suspend the Neminyak Conservancy from membership. That doesn't look great. It's sort of like if an employee quit and your response was, you can't quit because you're fired. Now, as we wrap up things here in this episode, I want to again make it clear that the findings in the Stealth Game report are allegations. Allegations that the NRT categorically denies across the board. And it's perfectly reasonable that the NRT has built this system with the true intention of protecting wildlife and helping local communities get to a place where they can thrive and maintain that on their own. Perhaps, though, along the way in getting there, some drawbacks of this type of system have shown up, and the NRT team is aiming to try to fix them rather than abandon the system overall. I don't know for certain. What is clear is that 80% of the biodiversity hotspots left on this planet are those occupied by indigenous communities. There is no real case that local peoples are not able to live off of and protect their lands without foreign support other than a lack of resources. Perhaps the real question becomes then, what sort of strings or partnerships should these resources come with? Some, like Enarata, advocate little to none at all. Others, like the NRT, feel that their involvement is necessary for success. Otherwise, they would not play the role they're playing today. You can be the judge. Start by reading the Stealth Game report, the NRT response, and the NRT annual report. I've linked all of them in the show notes. Feel free to reach out to both organizations as well if you wish to dig in even deeper. All right, that's it for this episode. Thank you for your support of the work we do here at Animalia. And most of all, thank you for anything and everything you do to support this big, beautiful planet and all the incredible life that calls it home. Till next time.